Violinist Daniel Hope has been involved with some incredible projects over the years, and he's worked with a lot of contemporary composers. His latest project is different. He's working with contemporary composers, but the global pandemic and the luxury of time allowed him to be more spontaneous. Musicians were available. There were composers and arrangers available who weren't busy doing other things. And the end result is a ray of hope. He calls the recording simply Hope. And it features him with the orchestra that he leads, the Zurich Chamber Orchestra. And it's the very first orchestra he ever experienced as a kid. So there's lots of incredible connections to his childhood on this new recording as well. It's called Hope, and that's what you're going to hear about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. Let's just start by having you tell me how you're doing. How are you? I mean, I think we're feeling like we're sort of on the other side of the worst of the pandemic, but you know, there are days where we think otherwise. So how have you been doing in general?
Yes, well, it's been an interesting time, I can say for sure, especially the last few weeks where things here in Europe are really starting to move again. And in fact, last night I had the season opening of our Zurich Chamber Orchestra, where we had 1,400 people in the hall. It's the most I've seen now in probably a year and a half. And it was a wonderful feeling, but also rather strange to get used to this idea of thousands of people enjoying classical music live again. And it was very emotional, I think, for all of us to reconnect with our audiences and to reconnect with the players and to kind of go back to where one was. At the beginning, it took us a while to get used to the concept, but then it happened very quickly and we were right back in there.
I'm wondering if we aren't going to get back to where we were, but we're going somewhere new, perhaps, in terms of our appreciation and the experience of being in a live concert. What are you sensing?
I think that things will definitely be different. I don't think it's possible to go back exactly to the way things were. And that's, I think, in general, the case. I think, you know, this whole experience of the pandemic has changed us, and it's changed the way we look at the world and each other and the way we listen to music and many other things. But I do think that there is an optimism again, which is out there, having got so used to negative ideas and thoughts and, you know, the next set of headlines. I think that people are generally feeling that there is a change coming and that we are somehow getting back to this idea of experiencing music, especially in the classical field. The festivals are now running. This idea of doing shortened concerts three times in a row, which we kind of went through over the summer, I think that's behind us now. And the presenters here are certainly going for it, you know, and just that there's remains an element of trepidation as to whether things will continue. But I think certainly on this side of the pond, there is optimism about the future.
You mentioned Switzerland, and you're working with the Swiss Chamber Orchestra based in Zurich. Tell me about that relationship.
I've been music director of the Zurich Chamber Orchestra now since 2016. So last night was the beginning of our sixth season together. And that's really an amazing orchestra. You know, I've known them really since I was a little boy. I heard them when I was 3 or 4 years old at the Menuhin Festival in Gstaad, as there used to be the resident orchestra of that festival. And it was the first orchestra that I heard, the first time I experienced violin concertos and symphonies. And this whole idea of an explosive and emotional orchestral sound came from that orchestra. And I never dreamed that, you know, 40-odd years later that I would be their music director. And we've grown enormously together over these last 6 years. And until the pandemic, certainly, we were traveling and touring regularly around the world. That stopped then, of course. But we were very active also during the lockdowns and went into the studio and made a number of recordings together. And I feel very close to them. Musically, they're great friends. And they also, similarly, I think they've been raring to go. And last night in particular, at the launch of the season, everyone felt that this was a watershed moment. There was no looking back.
One thing that you have done during the COVID lockdown is record with this ensemble, as you said, and a new recording has just been released called Hope. Now, of course, I can't help but just bring up the fact that your last name is Hope. So is there like a connection between creating this music filled with hope and your last name somehow with this project?
Well, you know, throughout the lockdown, when I started these series of online concerts, which we called Hope at Home, the messages that we were getting from around the world was that the hope that was being rediscovered through music was so important to people. And people were writing in and saying, please don't stop, please keep making music. You know, we are still in lockdown in whatever country we were in. And they were asking for specific pieces. And the connection between this idea of positive feelings and energy and music was so strong that I got to think, what would it be like to make an album which does try and tap into that positive energy? And whether one calls that hope or dreams or anything like that, I did feel there was a tremendous connection to the people out there. And that meant a lot to me during the lockdown, as I think it did also to others. And so that's really how this mosaic of an album came together in very difficult circumstances. Often we didn't really know if we'd be able to get this musician or that musician, if we'd be able to record together or remotely. And so we went on a kind of a day-by-day creative process, which is very different to the way that I usually would make my albums that sometimes have been planned over years or even decades.
You bring up that element of spontaneity, and that was really key to putting this recording together. Can you talk about how you did become more nimble-minded as you put the recording together? How did you connect with, because there's a lot of guest artists on this recording too.
Yes, I mean, a lot had to do with luck and circumstance. There were coincidences. I was doing an episode with Thomas Hampson, for example, in Bavaria of Hope at Home, and we were in the former house of Richard Strauss, which is the most unbelievable villa in a small town in the mountains. And we did this episode where he sang Strauss, we did this with Vaughan Williams, and he was talking about Stephen Foster.
Live always to smile upon earth and sky.
And he suddenly started singing this song of Stephen Foster to me, and it was so absolutely beautiful that I said, "What? We have to record this." And we had an arrangement made, and we were staying in a hotel which was about 30 minutes from there, and they had a hall in there with a piano. And we had the guys from Hope at Home who were doing the sound recording. So we got them in the evening and we just sat down and recorded it.
I find it fascinating that you're a violinist, yet you really wanted to focus on song and the human voice on this new recording. Talk more about that, please.
I did. You know, obviously for all musicians, it was very hard not to be able to perform and to travel during this time. But for singers in particular, there was something I found really, really tough. The idea of singing was banned, more or less. You were just not allowed to sing. And singing is the most natural reaction for anybody. You know, we sing from the earliest age, we listen to the songs that our parents sing to us, and suddenly this was considered almost, you know, illegal. And I felt enormously for singers and for people that do love to sing. And I thought the images of people singing from their balconies and connecting via Zoom, that was so powerful and so moving. So I thought, Let's put the idea of the human voice at the center of this album. And if we can't have only singers, we'll have songs at least, you know, which are songs perhaps of comfort, of hope, songs that connect to people at this very difficult time.
The recording opens with the sacred work by Argentine composer Ariel Ramirez, which you've known for many, many years. And you actually were able to commission a new arrangement of it when you were a teenager. Talk more about that and then how it evolved into what is on the recording.
Well, what actually happened was that, you know, I heard this piece as a small boy and I became obsessed by it and this gorgeous recording of José Carreras. And I said at the time to myself, one day I want to play this on the violin. First, I actually wanted to sing it, but I realized my voice wasn't good enough to do that. But I thought, why not create a version in which the violin is involved? And I had this idea, you know, for decades. And as I was studying, I got in touch with the publisher of the work, and I was able to secure the rights to make a violin version. That was, you know, way back ago. And it's always been up there somewhere in my head. And, you know, during the pandemic and the lockdown, we all had, I think, a lot of time on our hands. It was something which was, on the one side, a great luxury. And I started to think, and I came back again to this piece. I was listening to it a lot during the lockdown because it gave me great strength and great inspiration. And I thought maybe now is the time to make that arrangement happen. And I was in touch with Simon Halsey, the great choir director. We were going to have his choir from Barcelona come and record. And of course, that was not possible. And Simon said, what about doing a chamber version or even a soloistic version with just four singers? And I'm very lucky to know one of the great arrangers. His name is Paul Bateman. We've been working together now for the last 3 or 4 years. And for Hope at Home, the series, he even did 70 arrangements for us. Like almost every day he was making arrangements that we then performed in the evening. And so I called him up and I said, do you think we can make this work? And he said, that, you know, that's a big challenge to have a choral piece, a sacred choral piece, and to somehow make that into a violin orientated piece, let's call it that. I didn't want a violin concerto. I didn't want to lose the voices or the vocal aspect of it, but I wanted somehow to have the violin. And then he had this brilliant idea to keep the entire chorus, which is the Mass itself. It's the text of the Mass, the Holy Mass. And instead to replace one of the tenor lines with a violin. But not just that, to actually add an orchestra, because the original version doesn't have an orchestra in it. It's for choir, for piano and percussion instruments. And so he added a third voice, in fact, into there, which gave it this orchestral feel. And the orchestral feel, I think, fits then beautifully to the violin. So we then started to find out if we could somehow find these Argentine instruments and instrumentalists even to come on and do these tracks, because the indigenous side of that piece is tremendously important and I wanted to respect that. And we managed to actually get all of those elements together, which was extraordinary given the barriers that we were, you know, coming up against. The other interesting thing about this piece is that Ramirez, he visited Europe shortly after the Second World War, and he met many people who had a huge impact on him, including two sisters who told him the story that they had secretly helped concentration camp victims and prisoners by providing them secretly with food and clothing during their time and after they actually escaped. And he was so moved by this story that he decided to compose a Mass for mankind and for a better world, a piece which is about a better world. And so you have many elements in the piece. You have this South American indigenous music that goes between different countries in South America and has elements of their folk songs. It uses instruments, even ones from the Amazon forest. You're suddenly evoked. There's this amazing scene where you hear almost waterfalls and birdsong. Plus, you have the jubilation of the Holy Message, which is given this very, very energetic feel. So many elements come together in this piece, and I think that's one of the reasons why many people respond to it in a very strong way.
It's an incredible piece. I mean, when I put it on, I don't think I've ever heard it before, and then of course I hadn't heard it in this arrangement either. So it's just so vibrant.
You know, I had this idea with the whole choir, and we had only four magnificent voices. We couldn't believe it when they started singing, just the four of them. It sounded like a choir. Was so finely tuned and so well prepared. We realized we have a different piece here because I had to reimagine a lot of the texture and the orchestration. We added different instruments, added percussion instruments on the spot, in fact, on different layers of tracks, because the solo voices created new colors that we had no idea we even would hear. So we were working as we were recording, we were building this piece together, and so that was absolutely fascinating.
I want to talk about the John Dowland piece. Time Stands Still by John Dowland, so perfect, so relevant for our times. Talk about this piece and its arrangement and what we're hearing.
Stand still and gaze for minutes, hours, and years to give place.
So John Dowland, as I think many well know, was one of the most unusual and important composers of the English Renaissance, somebody that has really been discovered in the last, I would say, 10 years. The early music scene, of course, for many years were recording him, but I think he became even more famous thanks to Sting, who did a beautiful album of his music about 10 years ago and also fell in love with his form of expression. And there's this song which is called Time Stands Still, and I performed it with an a cappella ensemble with whom I had been working for the last few years on and off. And when the pandemic firstly looked as if it was going to subside and the first lockdown ended, we went out with the Hope at Home project and started doing some concerts around Germany in certain venues that had very slowly started to open, and we performed in the cathedral in Dresden, and Amachord, which is the name of this group, they said, can we do this song together? And they sent me the music to Time Stands Still, and I was just absolutely blown away by it, the beauty and the simplicity at the same time. And there is something about it where you do feel as if the world has just stopped. And I thought this is perfect for what we're trying to express here. I think we've all had the expression that our world was put on pause somehow. The world did stop. And this vocal, almost a chanting sound that comes out of of these gentlemen when they play. An amazing closeness, a proximity harmonically that they have when they sing, kind of non-vibrato, very pure and just beautiful. And the lead singer said to me, why don't you just play one of our lines and try and join us somehow? And of course, you know, a violin is a vocal instrument, but it's very different when it plays with a singing ensemble that knows each other that well. You have to try and find a color that doesn't disrupt the beauty and the precision of those voices. And so we really experimented with it in that concert, and we all said at the end of that concert, wow, this is really something. We've never experienced that before. They'd never played with a violinist, and I hadn't played with an a cappella ensemble like that. I think this is really something special, and it gives, again, the album a very different feel and a different musical and emotional feel. They are magnificent singers, and they're so open to experimentation. And let's say the difference between that Time Stand Still and the Nimrod by Elgar from the Enigma Variations. Which they really wanted to do because they love that music as I do too. None of us knew how that might work, again, a piece which is so well known. And is the violin part of the ensemble, or is the ensemble in a sense providing an orchestral background for the instrument? I think both are the case. But it was very inspirational to be able to do that and to try and place the violin into a different realm.
There are also some pieces that stem from your childhood. Of course, we already talked about the Mass, but there are some songs. Can you talk about what that was like for you to bring those back?
Yes, Danny Boy is a piece that really goes back to my earliest childhood and to the Irish part of my family. On my father's side, it's all Irish, more or less going back to the Middle Ages, and I'm named after my Irish great-grandfather who was called Danny, and it's kind of a hymn of the family, really. My grandmother, my Irish grandmother, always used to sing it to us. It was one of the first pieces that I played as a violinist in the Fritz Kreisler arrangement, and again, I looked for pieces that with which I could identify and that really spoke to me. People were asking me to do certain pieces, and I tried to accommodate what I could, but it was also important for me to go back to where I came from musically and to those earliest memories, and that's why Musa Criolla was one of them, Danny Boy's another, Dream a Little Dream, you know, the Dean Martin record is the version that my father would always listen to when I was growing up. You know, it was Dean Martin and Elvis. You know, we're our closest musical allies growing up at home. And that recording of Dean Martin, you know, is still, it brings out so many memories to me and so many associations. And I think we were all looking for some kind of grounding and some kind of solace, I guess, during this time. That's why I often went back to my childhood in the music and placed them then on this album. Most of them in brand new arrangements, which then Paul Bateman again did. You know, he was at work day and night for me and for us during this whole time, and what a brilliant arranger he is, because I would also tell him the story of what the music meant to me. It wasn't just, here's the piece and please arrange it for violin and orchestra, but, you know, this is what I think about. You know, this is the bit my grandmother used to sing a little higher or a little faster, or, and so he somehow managed to convey that feeling within the arrangement itself, and that I'm really just in awe of him.
There is a world premiere recording on this new release. Tell me about the composer and the piece and why it was important for you to include it on Hope.
You know, I've worked a lot with living composers, you know, for the last 30 years, and Beshara El-Khoury is, for me, a most fascinating composer. He's from Lebanon. He escaped during the war and as a young boy went to Paris, where he lives. And his music really straddles both East and West. He has this connection to Lebanon, to Lebanese culture and phrasing and musical language, and yet he's also deeply French, I would say. And so it's a very interesting synthesis that takes place. And I rang him up and I said, you know, Besh, is there any way that you might write something for us that we could actually create something new for this album? And he said that he got to work right away. It's typical Beshara. He went straight to the manuscript paper, and this is what came out. He said it's his most deeply felt piece, in fact, and he calls it Byblos, which I think was interesting, which has an old biblical connotation, goes back to one of the oldest cities in the world. And again, for him, it was about going back in time, in fact, to the beginnings of time. And we're both connected to a wonderful clarinetist, Patrick Messina, who I admire enormously. And he said, I'd like to write a piece for both of you, for clarinet and violin and orchestra. And it's going to be a dialogue between the two of you. It'll be a dialogue between East and West. And I'm writing it specifically for both of you and for the way that you play and the way you think. And that was very special. You know, to collaborate with composers is always wonderful, but to have that personal aspect to it and to work with a clarinetist of Patrick's dimension is mind-blowing, really. He's quite extraordinary. We would play it through. Beshara would be on the Zoom in Paris, and he would say, no, let's try this, or take this out, or, you know, put in a ritardando here, or play it with more passion there. And again, that was changing constantly. And to see music change in front of your eyes is very, really a very wonderful thing. You realize, you know, how what a living and breathing commodity it is. And it comes to life in front of you. And in this situation where everybody was so nervous and unexpected, it added to the general feeling of I think real awe that we had, not knowing what was going to come out at the end.
Oh, that's so cool, because sometimes, especially in the world of classical music, everything is very prescribed, right? We've got a score, and, you know, there's this expectation to speak, you know, the voice the composer had intended from hundreds of years ago. So it's so cool to hear you talk in such an energetic way about creating something new. And that actually drives another point home about this recording, how there were a lot of musicians kind of waiting in the wings for something to happen during COVID, and you gave them something to do. then they also had an additional purpose, right? Tell me a little bit about that community and how you pulled all that together.
Yeah, I mean, it really was very, very moving to see musicians, you know, either come into the studio if we could get them in Berlin, or remotely. We did a lot of work remotely, but we were watching them on the cameras, and, you know, that feeling, here we are, and we're making music again. You know, there were many tears, and there was laughter, and there was this feeling of purpose again. And many musicians said to me, you know, either the Hope at Home episodes or this recording was, if not the only, then some of the only work that they did during that time. And so they threw all the emotions into those sessions. And the Zurich Chamber Orchestra, which recorded much of it, you know, we did do in person in Zurich. And that was the first time the orchestra played together for months. And this feeling of, here we are again, you know, we're alive and we're making music, and this music is going to reach people. It gave one a sense of purpose. And then we had the teams of producers and sound engineers. Again, you know, everybody went into that studio firstly with trepidation, because this is what they do, and they hadn't done it for such a long time. They were nervous whether they would be able to switch back on again and everything, let everything happen. And so this feeling in every single take, even the takes we didn't use, that the feeling of a sense of purpose was very, very special. It gave us all, I think, a new sense of life. And me most of all, I loved being able to do it. I loved listening to people playing again and to realize what a privilege it is to make music and to share music.
Putting together this Ray of Hope recording, what did you discover about yourself?
I think that I've always been obsessed with music. I've always been, you know, I like to say infected with music. It's probably not the right word, but it's music just doesn't let me go. And I always knew that it was the central focus of my life. But it became a lifeline. It became a lifeline to the outside world for me. And I realized how many wonderful musicians out there are open to collaboration and to experimentation. And one of the good things about the pandemic was that you had access to musicians who would have been so busy and so occupied with so many things that you would never ever have been able to get together and suggest certain things and have the luxury of improvisation within a recording process. And that really, I think, changed the way I listen and think about recordings and making music in general. And I'm just tremendously lucky to know these musicians and to be able to work with them and to have had the chance in this time in which we put the world was put on pause to go into that dimension and dedicate my time and energy solely to music, not with any of the distractions that we have in our regular world. And that, I think, has certainly changed me as a musician and changed the way I listen to phrases and what I think is possible. And it's set the bar pretty high, I think, for future recordings, because, you know, we won't have that luxury again, I think. That was a unique time in our world. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens next.
a new recording that provides a ray of hope from violinist Daniel Hope. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer for New Classical Tracks. And since you're clearly a music fan, here's another podcast you might want to check out, The Piano Puzzler. Every week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. And Bruce takes a familiar tune, disguises it in the style of a classical composer, and then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. And if you're up for the challenge, subscribe to The Piano Puzzler, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're enjoying this podcast, New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, the best thing you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Amacher.